I want to speak to a man I always associate with being a leading journalist, Jonathan McCambridge, who is probably you would associate with the Belfast Telegraph. Jonathan, good morning.
Morning, Frank. How do you? You can call me Johnny.
Yeah, absolutely. We can call you Johnny because that's how we know you. Johnny, I'm just thinking here. You have been writing some amazing stuff on a blog that you're now doing. Are you still working as a journalist or have you come away totally from the Belfast Telegraph?
No, Frank. I've left journalism altogether for about 6 months now, although some people consider blogging, I suppose, a form of journalism in itself. I'm a daddy now. I'm a full-time daddy. Don't work in the newspapers anymore, and do a little bit of blogging on the side, and that's my life.
Yeah, because this blog is called What's a Daddy For? And the first thing that crosses my mind would be, you know, little sweet things about bringing up Junior. But some of what you've been writing has been on the edge. It's you're dealing with issues, dealing with your own personal issues, and it's a window to your world, but it's also maybe in many ways a window to the world of people who are less confident, people who aren't prepared to talk about, for example, depression.
Yes, Frank, I think that's a very good way of introducing it, because whenever I started the blog, it was pretty much exactly as you said. My intention for it was to be something which would be reasonably lighthearted, and still a lot of it is, telling stories about my child growing up and our interaction, etc. But I suppose as I moved along in the journey, I met different people within the blogging world and had different experiences, and some of the stuff I found that I wanted to write about was more serious, and particularly with my own personal experiences with mental health. People who've been reading the blog will be familiar with some of this, the fact I'd suffered from depression, anxiety. I was hospitalised a few years back in psychiatric ward, suffered a number of breakdowns, and this was partly the reason why in the end I had to come away from work and journalism, as it were. And I suppose the reason why I started doing it, Frank, and it was a very personal thing and quite a difficult decision to make, but it was a form of therapy for me, in the sense that I'd done a lot of counselling, I'd done a lot of techniques, cognitive behavioural therapy, mindfulness, and some of them had worked to varying levels, but some people had said to me, why don't you try, because writing was always my thing, why don't you try writing as therapy in order tell your story, put it into words, write it down. And I found it was very useful in the sense of understanding sometimes things that were going on in your own head that perhaps you couldn't quite grasp, and then when you wrote it down, all of a sudden it made a little bit more sense. And there was a feeling of almost catharticism about that, where it was purging. And then whenever I decided to share it publicly, I was sort of taken aback, I suppose, by the response I got from other people coming forward and saying, yes, I know exactly what you found. I have those mental health difficulties. I've suffered from depression. I've suffered from anxiety, low mood at various different levels. So the feeling of, I suppose, support that you got when you've gone through all these years thinking, oh, it's just me. All of a sudden you thought, oh gosh, it's not just me, it's so many other people as well. Some of them are happy to talk about it publicly, but a lot of them want to keep it private, and that's okay as well. But just knowing, and a lot of people have come to me and said, look, it's just great to have somebody doing this and being unafraid, I suppose, to do it, and it's given me a lot of succour.
When you were at your lowest ebb, Johnny, when you were feeling you had to come away from journalism and you were needing treatment, how bad was it for you?
There's been a number of lowest ebbs, I suppose, Frank, over the years. I mean, my very, very lowest, I mean, there was continual thoughts of suicide, and, you know, without going into too much detail, you know, I got very close to that on a number of occasions. I was at a point once where I was seeing a doctor, and she said to me, either you go into a psychiatric ward now voluntarily, or else we're going to section you. So, I mean, that gives you an idea of quite how bad it was. Obviously, they thought at that point I was a danger to myself, and I went into that mental health ward on that first night. And I remember being in the bed and not quite knowing what was happening, and this male nurse coming round and shining, it was dark, and shining a little torch into my eyes, and I didn't know what was going on. And then I realised I was on suicide watch, and they were shining this little light into my eyes to see if I was still alive or if I'd done something myself. So, I mean, those were the darkest days, but it came, I suppose, almost in a cyclical way. It came round like that. You know, you would get better, you thought you were doing well, then you would fall again. And each time you fell, it seemed to be a little bit worse, because you'd always got your hopes up that things were getting better, that you'd got, particularly what I had done is I had bottled it up for years and years and years. And whenever I finally admitted I had a problem and got the medical help, and then still after that to find myself in this bad situation was even more crushing, because you thought, okay, I've done it now, I've spoken, I've shared, but still I'm feeling the depression. And what I suppose you learn is there's no solution, one solution that fits every person. I mean, for some people it can be medication, for some people it's counselling, different treatments. You know, there's no one thing for me. The writing helps a bit, talking to lots of other people, knowing that I'm part of this network, and lots of people are supporting me, and I'm helping hopefully some other people along the way. That's been, you know, a great help for myself. But it really is different for each person, and that's what's so tricky about mental health. And the other aspect of it, I suppose, which is what really needs to be tackled, is the stigma that people have around it. And I mean, you know, as I do, Frank, from moving around in the world of journalism, how, you know, it's got this sort of macho image about it, and there are so many things that people just won't talk about. And it's not, you know, exclusive to this profession or any other, it's across them all. But just this feeling that people, the number of people who have these issues going on, but just don't think they can talk about it because they think, you know, there won't be a welcome for them, there won't be a sympathetic ear. And that's really I think that's really what I'm trying to do, is to help people actually, it's okay to talk about it. And I suppose, you know, what some people have said to me as well, because you're a man, it's even more unusual for a male to come forward and talk about some of these things. And, you know, we all know what the suicide rate is among men and all that, and it's terrifying. And, you know, so breaking down these barriers and taboos is very important to me.
So when you write and when you liaise with your counsellor, when maybe you may take some medication, I'm not sure, but are there times when you still feel low, or is life much better now generally?
I always tell people I'm in a better place now, but you can never be complacent, Frank. And still, I would have up and down days and bad days, and, you know, today might be good, tomorrow might be less good. I think probably, I mean, if there was a point where I say things began to get a lot better for me, when I was able to identify a moment when things started to improve, was whenever I realised that I was never probably going to get entirely better, which is a strange way of putting it, but I always had a sort of idea that I would beat this, I would be off the medication, I would be absolutely fine, I would never have depression again. And whenever I then fell, it was, you know, crushing in my mind. Whenever I came, I suppose, to the realisation that actually you can't beat it, it's part of you, and it's something that you live with, and you control it, and you contain it, and you accept it, then it started to become a lot easier to deal with, because I thought, this is my mind, you cannot fight against your own mind, and what goes on in your own mind, and the feelings that go on in your mind. And the strange thing is, Frank, you can be having a very, very good day, you know, you can be the happiest time of your life, you can be having a great day with your kids, a great day out, but you can still have thoughts in your own mind which are not healthy, they're not good, and all you can do is really accept, well, that's your mind and that's how it works, and then it's okay, or it's better than it was. And, you know, as I say, today's good, tomorrow maybe less so, the next day who knows. But, you know, I think whenever you've come through a lot of really low times and a lot of really low moments, it does then give you extra encouragement going forward to know that you can get through it and you can get better. And now having this, you know, for years feeling that I was fighting this lone battle, now feeling that I'm part of a huge network of people. And since I've started doing this blog, you know, I've had communication from charities, different people who run classes, courses that are, you know, asking me to come along and meet people and talk to people, do a little bit of public speaking, do a bit of writing. So this is, you know, it's opened up a whole new world. And, you know, I'm trying to make the best of it that I can.
Absolutely. I can imagine that people listening to you speak, people who are coping with some sort of mental challenge, who have turned the volume on the radio up just to hear what you're saying, because you can listen to doctors, you can listen to analysts, you can listen to so-called experts, but when you listen to a real patient who's as eloquent as you are on it, Johnny, it's bound to be inspirational for people who are facing the challenge. And in this latest blog, you also touch on eating issues, which are in some way linked to your depression.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is a slight side issue, but you know, part of this for me is a learning process, and I don't really plan any of it, and I never really know what I'm going to blog about next. It all sort of just happens, and I suppose I'll give you briefly the background. My brother showed me a photograph of myself which was really taken just slightly over a year ago. It was about 16 months, and at the time I was exercising, I was training, and I'd just run the Belfast Marathon, and I looked at this photograph now a year on, you know, I'm not training at that level anymore, and it scared me. It really scared me. I mean, people can go on my blog, what's the daddy for, and to look at the photograph, it's skeletal. And, you know, my face, my arms, you know, my body, it looked like it was wasting away. And I thought, I looked at this now and I thought, oh my God, what was I doing? You know, allowing myself to get to the point where I was so thin. But the really scary point, and this is where it sort of takes you into slightly other areas, was I remember at the time when I was running, looking at myself and thinking nothing was wrong. In fact, if anything, I was thinking I could probably do with losing a few more pounds. And that was really scary, because that then takes you into the area of thinking, look at how your own brain can play tricks on yourself. At that time, when I was obviously feeling a lot less happy than I am now, I was looking at myself in the mirror and thinking, gosh, I need to lose weight. Now I look at the photograph and I look like a skeleton, and that was just one of those moments that you'll never forget, about how your mind can do that to yourself. And, you know, I suppose it opened up then the blog. I talked about my own unusual, I mean, I'd never say I've got an eating disorder, because I do, you know, a lot of people have a lot worse issues in these areas than I have, but a very unusual sort of relationship I've had with food, where there's been times where I can't eat, you know, my anxiety for long periods of months, you know, I can't eat, probably my anxiety doesn't allow me to eat. And then other periods where I do eat and I can't stop eating, and I overeat and I gorge myself to the point where I make myself sick. And then that leads to a level of depression itself, a worthlessness, because you think, you know, why can I not control my... So I've had both of it, and that might seem unusual for people to hear that, but I've had the anxiety which stops me eating, and then I've had the insecurity which makes me eat too much, and somewhere in the middle of it, you're my weight seesawing and juggling around and all sorts. And then I saw this photograph, and, you know, that was a time in my life when I was very unhappy, and I threw, you know, I was supposed just past 40, and I threw myself into exercise. You know, a lot of people would get to a certain age to think, oh, I need to look after myself, which was exactly what I did. But rather than doing something gentle like a 5K or going for a walk two or three times a week, I decided from nothing I was going to train and run a marathon. And that gives you, I suppose, an insight into the obsessive personality that, you know, that I had. It sort of feeds many of my issues. And I was training 6 days a week, running 70, 80 miles a week, getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning in the dark to go out and do these long, long runs. And I, you know, I became very, very fit very quickly. I became a hell of a runner. But there was a downside to it as well, which, and whenever I looked at that photograph, I suppose that's what brought it home to me. You can be very fit physically, but mentally, I looked at my face and I looked at my eyes and I thought, oh no, that wasn't a happy time for me. And now I'm probably, I don't know, I don't weigh myself, but I'd say I'm probably maybe two or three stone heavier. I've got a little bit of a stomach, but I'm a lot better and a lot happier for it.
Well, it's a really interesting read, Johnny. Just one final question, briefly. How many youngsters do you actually have, or was this sparked by your first youngster?
I just got one, and one, to be honest, Frank. Plenty for me. It's a handful. People who have more than one, they've got my unending admiration. And I've got one little boy, James. He's 4 years old, and he starts P1 tomorrow. So there's going to be a lot of tears, and that's just me. And you can all read about it on my blog over the coming days, because I anticipate it's going to be quite an interesting week starting school. But I'm having, honestly, Frank, it's a great experience. You know, from from living, you know, the life of a journalist, which I did for 20 years. I've had a wonderful time, met so many people, and still in contact with them, and it was a wonderful life. Now I'm doing this. Now I'm, you know, I'm looking after my little boy, and you know, it's a wonderfully fulfilling experience to be a daddy.
It's great listening to you, Johnny. It really, really is, and I know people who have sought some assistance will be getting it from listening to you, and I'd love to hear from people what their reaction is to you being on the radio. The blog is called What's a Daddy For? Jonathan, Johnny McCambridge, What's a Daddy For? You can follow it. And we'll, what's your young man's name again?
Hey, James.
James, we look forward to how James gets on at school. Johnny, really appreciate your openness and your frankness with us. Thanks, Johnny. Thank you.
Anytime. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Really interesting guy. And I hope that has been of benefit to you if you are facing some challenges yourself. If you'd like to give us some feedback on Johnny being on the radio, you know the number.
The Frank Mitchell phone-in on U105. Here for you.